talk about quantum teleportation. I'd say in some ways it was quantum teleportation that set in set in play the sort of quantum information revolution. I mean, the quantum computing is in some ways a separate strand, but the idea that quantum states convey information, you can't clone the information, but you can teleport it, was a very influential idea. And I think Aggie sent the paper around, is that right? Oh, you haven't, okay, Aggie's going to do that. And it's the original teleportation paper is an extremely good read. You can sit down, you'll be able to read it. It's not difficult, but it's full of interesting insights. So here's the idea. You have a quantum state here, and this is we'll take this to be a qubit. So alpha 0 plus beta 1. And we put this on a system of type A, instance 1. Okay. We want to get this to the other side without directly sending it. So this is the way it works. Space here. The two parties, Alice and Bob, share an entangled state. So this is the source of the entangled state. The entangled state now goes off in this two directions. It's possible that they shared this entangled state previously. They may have shared it, you know, the day before yesterday when it was cheap to share entanglement, and then just stored those two particles at each end ready for the purpose of teleporting. And now they make a certain measurement. Oh, I should say this entangled state is taken to be a maximally entangled state this state. And it's shared between two particles, which we'll call 2 and 3. Now, this is Alice. She makes a measurement on the particle that she wants to teleport and the entangled particle that she has in her possession, and she makes it on a certain orthogonal basis. So the basis she makes the measurement onto is the Bell basis. This consists of four states. Which are these four states? Sorry, that's I missed a mistake there. These four states. Yeah, go.
The zero and the one.
Where? Here?
One of them. It's,
yeah. There we go. Okay, so we got there. These four states. If you look at this set of four states, they're orthogonal to each other. So you can see that this pair of states are orthogonal because of this plus and minus, and likewise this pair. And this any state from here is orthogonal to any state from here because they simply don't overlap when you take the inner product. you can do that calculation quickly. So we want to make a measurement here on this basis, on these two particles, and see what happens. Let me. Well, to see what will happen, let's just write the state down in an appropriate form. This is the start, this is the state that we start with. So I'm simply taking this state and I'm re-expressing it in a useful form. Okay, so we've re-expressed it, so we have four different terms. And you can just sit down, if you like, and do this calculation. It's pretty straightforward. You just substitute in these Bell states here, and then multiply through and check that everything cancels down to this expression. So now imagine we perform a measurement into this orthogonal Bell basis here. Then what happens is, depending on the outcome, Bob's particle is projected into the thing that's in the brackets. Whichever outcome we get, Bob's particle is projected into what's left in these brackets. So if we get this outcome, the phi plus outcome, then we know that Bob's state is the same state that was that came in originally. And so then we don't have to do anything. We have the state that we wanted to teleport. If we have this outcome, phi minus, then the state we have is almost the same as the one that was sent in, except it's got this minus sign. And it's very simple in that case to apply a unitary which corrects the minus sign. You just apply this transformation to the state, and that will correct the minus sign and turn it into the state that was originally sent in. In this case, you just do the identity. In this case, we have almost the state that was sent in, except the 1 and the 0 are in the wrong places. So we just swap the 1 and the 0, and there's a unitary that will do that. Is that. And in this case, we get the psi minus outcome. Well, then we have both problems, so we just have to do both things. And there's a unitary that will do that. So the scheme is Alice makes the Bell measurement on her pair of particles. draw the picture again here. And then she sends the classical result of that bell measurement to Bob. And now Bob performs a unitary transformation on his particle according to the result that he was sent. And then the particle that comes out at the upper end, K, the classical information that's sent, the particle that comes out the upper end is in the same state as the original particle going in. Any questions on this?
Sorry, what are you sending from Bob to you?
So you're sending classical information. You're sending the number. You're saying Ivy had this outcome, this one, or this one. So that means you're sending one of four possible classical information, which is equivalent to sending two classical bits. So what you're sending is two. You've previously shared entanglement, but you did that maybe the day before. So the entanglement isn't, in some sense, isn't the one that's sending information, but it is obviously playing an important role. So there's an interesting question here, which is, how is this possible? Because if you look at this thing, here you have two real numbers, or actually two complex numbers. So there's an infinite number of possible settings for alpha and beta, continuous infinity of different settings. And this alpha and beta appear over here, this infinite number of different possible settings, and yet you've only sent two classical bits of information. It seems like you've achieved the impossible. You've managed to send an infinite number of classical bits just using two classical bits by sharing entanglement previously. That's something to puzzle over in your spare time.
What are we doing here? Are we using the entangled pair and the classical bits to move quantum information?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we have a previously shared entanglement, and then two classical bits, and that makes it possible to send this quantum information from there to there.
So can we treat them as like? Can we do like an equation that makes sense that says classical bit somewhere, entangled bit here?
I mean, people write down equations like let's see if I can remember things like. One EPR pair plus two classical bits it allows you to communicate one quantum bit. So you can write down all sorts of equations, and you can write down more general equations than that for more complicated situations. So the important thing is, although you can send, although it looks like you're sending an infinite amount of information in these parameters, you can't use this infinite amount of information to do an infinite amount of classical communication. So from that point of view, there isn't an inconsistency. There is a question, well, how much classical communication can I achieve with this amount of quantum information? So we know if we have a quantum bit, we can achieve at least one classical bit of communication, because you can just send a zero or a one. But we can do a bit better than that. I'll show you how that works. So I'm going to show you quantum dense coding, which is, in some sense, the dual to teleportation. So imagine you have the possibility of sending one quantum bit . The word qubit is now in the Oxford Dictionary. It was invented by Ben Schumacher. So I think that's always a great feat if you can get your invented word into the Oxford Dictionary. So I have one qubit. I can send it from Alice to Bob. And I want to use it to send as much classical information as I can. Well, here's the way to do it. You can share some entanglement previously between Alice and Bob. And now, if I can, you and let's try to communicate two classical bits. I'll show you in a minute that this is the maximum amount you can communicate. So two bits. So I have one of four pieces of information. I can use this to apply the same unitaries, one of these four unitaries, to the entangled state. Let's assume the entangled state we start with is the phi plus state. So this is a, what all I'm doing now is I'm sending this particle, first of all, to Alice, and then it's going to apply a unitary, then send it on the way back to over to Bob. Okay. So I apply one of four unitaries, according to which piece of classical information I want to send. And after I've done that, the state that Alice and Bob share will be one of these four maximally entangled states, one of the four Bell states. Okay, and those states are orthogonal. So when Bob receives this qubit over here, he can just do a Bell measurement, and he'll get an answer, and that answer will give him the classical information that was sent in. So he can so it's possible for Alice to send two classical bits to Bob using a quantum bit, as long as they have shared entanglement. This is often called an EPR state. any questions on that? So one question is it possible? So one question is it possible to do teleportation with less than two classical bits? Another question is it possible to send more than two classical bits using one qubit? Okay. Which one should we do first? What we can do is we can put a teleportation diagram inside here. Okay. And we know this will work if we send two classical bits in. then we have these two classical bits here. then we get two classical bits to Bob. Now, okay, let me just remember how the argumentation goes here. So we can see that to do teleportation, we can see we can't send more than two classical bits here, because we know we have in the middle here a constraint that there's only two classical bits going through. So that tells us that the maximum number of classical bits we can send using an entangled pair is two. Now there's another diagram, which to do around, take it here. So we put dense coating inside the teleportation circuit. And if we look here, we can see we can't send more than one qubit of information with two classical bits, because in the middle here, we only have one qubit traveling between the two ends. So there's a sort of sense in which these two diagrams, these two processes, quantum dense coding and teleportation, are dual to each other. Any questions on that? There's one more interesting thing here, which appears in the original teleportation paper, and that's entanglement swapping. So imagine I'm doing teleportation. So like so. What about if the original state, the original particle that comes in, is one of a pair of particles which are in some arbitrary entangled state? So here I have particle 1, particle 2, particle 3. Now let's say this is particle 0. So imagine the original state is actually some arbitrary entangled state. Coming in, then, well, after you've done the teleportation, the thing you have left over is particle 0 and particle 3. And the question is, what state are they in? And the answer is that they are in this entangled state. So what you've done here is that you swapped the entanglement that was previously existing between particles 0 and 1. So it now exists between particles 0 and 3. And the reason for that is, if you look at this calculation, it's entirely linear. And you can do this explicitly by writing it down, but just in words, any entanglement that exists between particle 1 and particle 0 will simply be swapped over to exist between particle 1 and particle 3. The whole thing is linear, so it will have that. Any questions on this? Okay. So let me move on to the last of the sort of novel quantum phenomena I want to present. I mean, there are many, many sort of novel phenomena in quantum theory that are interesting to study. But I'll present just one more. So the quantum Zeno effect, this is from 1977. Tudorshan and Misra. So imagine we have, I'll just tell you in words what happens. We have some system, it's in a certain state, we can call that state 0, doesn't matter. And then we allow it to evolve for a short time. And then we make a measurement onto a basis which included the original state that it was in. Okay, and we'll see what happens. And we'll find out that there's a kind of suppression of evolution effect that you get in quantum theory that you don't have in classical theory. So. Start with some system A in the state A0. Now we want to evolve this system for a short time. So we apply, we have some Hamiltonian. We apply the corresponding unitary evolution. Is this something that's familiar from a course somewhere? To that state zero. And if we do that, the state will evolve to, well, we can expand e to the I, all this stuff out. And then just look at the first few terms, because that will give us enough information. That's the first few terms. And next, we want to perform a measurement that projects onto the original state. If we so we have two possible answers. Either we see that it's in the original state, or we see that it's not in the original state. So this is the projector corresponding to it being not being in the original state. Okay. And if we expand, we can imagine this state has you know, some number of states available to it, and expand it out in some orthogonal basis. So this counts over all the states except the zero state. So this system has n plus one orthogonal states. You either project onto the zero state or onto this thing. Okay. So if you look at this state here, we can see the probability of it being in the zero state. Sorry, the probability of it not being in the zero state. So if we make that projection measurement, it's simply given by to first order in delta t, it's given by this term. Where so what I'm going to do is I'll take this state here, and I'll sandwich it on each side of the p bar zero, p zero bar. that. is that clear? Nope. Now we can see that this, we can effectively cross this bit out because they're just going to return zero, and there's no zero inside here. And so this is what we get. Sorry, say it again.
Is it for k squared or for the probability?
Oh, yeah, sorry, this is actually right. This is for the probability. This is with delta t in as well. Good. So we get some positive number here. So if this is the probability of the particle being in a different state, not being in the zero state, then the probability of it being in the zero state is equal to 1 minus that. And the important point about this formula is that we have a t squared. So the probability of decay goes as t squared, not as t. And you can contrast that with the situation in classical physics. So let's, for example, consider exponential decay. So what we have, so here's exponential decay, the probability that the particle has decayed after time delta t is given by e to the delta t over some half-life. And if we expand that out, it's to first order, it's linear in delta t. And this is going to be the case for any classical decay of this sort. If we draw a graph, the probability of, sorry, this is the probability of not decaying. Well, there should also be some constant here, obviously. if we draw a graph, then in the quantum case, it has this flat region where it goes as delta t squared before sort of any sort of linear dynamic sets in. Whereas in the quantum case, it goes as delta t from the outset. So to make this vivid, we can imagine that we have a quantum system, and we keep looking at it. So every time, every delta t, every interval delta t, we look again. So we keep making this same measurement over and over again. So let's see what will happen if we keep looking. So the probability the system is still in the zero state after some time t is equal to the probability that it hasn't decayed after the first step, and then after the second step, and so on. To the power n. So n is the number of steps. So the probability it hasn't decayed after n steps, after n measurements, each spaced by time delta t, is the probability to the power. Or it hasn't decayed after one step to the power n. And here n is just equal to the total time divided by the interval between the steps. Okay, well, if we expand this out, just look at the first term in delta t. Well, we multiply that term by this. We get that. So we can see that the probability that it hasn't decayed after some finite time, after some time t, which could be quite big, is just equal to the, it's just proportional, sorry, the probability it hasn't decayed is 1 minus something which is proportional to delta t. And if delta t tends to 0, the probability it hasn't decayed tends to 1. So what that means is if you keep looking at your system, then it won't change. It's sometimes called the watched pot effect. If you keep looking, the system won't decay. Contrast that with the case of classical decay. If I was to do the same calculation here, where I have a linear constraint, if I put that into here, where this is linear, I haven't got this square, then the delta t's will cancel, and I'll just get something which does change in time. So for a classical system, if you keep looking, it still will evolve in time as before. So this is telling you that by measuring repeatedly the quantum system, you're affecting it, and in this case, you're stopping the decay. Any questions? Okay, so what I want to do now is look ahead a little bit, because in the last week I'm going to be talking about quantum theory, axioms for quantum theory, and so on. And I want to look ahead a little bit, and just to get you thinking, and especially in the light of this quantum Mazzino effect, talk a bit about how we can think about quantum theory. In a sort of general probabilistic way. So the quantum Zeno effect I just described is related to the fact that evolution in quantum theory is linear in Hilbert space, and yet you calculate probabilities from Hilbert space by taking the squares of amplitudes. And it's sort of related to some facts. Well, let me just draw some pictures. So imagine we have a classical system which has some number of distinct states, like a die or a coin. Well, let's just consider something with three distinct states. So we have probabilities of three states. They're all distinguishable from one another. We can prepare the system so it's definitely in state one. So this is probability one, definitely in state one. So then the probability for it being in state two or state three is zero. We can do the same thing here, same thing here. Or we can prepare any combination of those things. So our system could have probability 0.25 to be in 1, 0.5 to be in 2, and 0.25 to be in 3. So this plane tells you all the states that you can prepare. And actually, often it's useful to think, allow yourself to have states which are subnormalized, where the total probability doesn't add up to 1. I'll talk about the reasons for that in the last week. And in that case, actually, you can prepare any state inside this quadrant up to this plane. So you can prepare a state at the very center on the origin, and any state up to this plane. So the state space is given by, in this case, given by this object that is bounded by this plane and in the positive quadrant. State is given by a list of probabilities, P1, P2, and P3. In the general case, where you have n distinguishable states, the state is given by a list like that. And the constraint is that all these numbers are positive and the sum is less than or equal to 1. Those two equations define the state space for classical systems. These are classical discrete systems. What about quantum theory? So I'll just illustrate the simplest case. We have a quantum bit or a spin half particle. In quantum theory, the state of a spin half particle is given, or any particle is given by the density matrix. For a spin half particle, you can write that down like this. We write it in a particular basis, and we have spin up probability along the z direction, spin down probability along the z direction on the diagonal, and then A and A star, which are some complex numbers, on the off diagonal. And you can show that A is equal to this. This is just a matter of doing a calculation, but this is what you get if you you calculate this off-diagonal coefficient in terms of some probabilities. In the case where you have a particle which is definitely pointing up, it has probability of z plus equal to 1, then z minus is equal to 1, so this term is just equal to 1. And now px plus will be equal to a half, as it's pointing up, and py plus also will be equal to a half. So you can see that these two terms cancel, and you get a 0 there. Anyway. If you do this, if this is the state and this is true, then clearly, if you have this set of four probabilities, you can calculate the quantum state. And the same is true vice versa. All these probabilities are calculable from the quantum state. So these two objects are linearly equivalent to each other. The fact that it's linear comes from the fact that this equation is linear. And so so this is an equally good way of representing the state in quantum theory. And it's reminiscent of what we have over here for classical theory, just a list of probabilities. And indeed, you can set up a general theory for probabilistic, a general framework for probabilistic theories, where you just represent states by lists of probabilities in general. OK. Any questions? So I've drawn the state space over here for this classical case. What about here for this quantum case? Anyone give a description of the state space? The quantum case? This is for a qubit, two and a half qubit. It's a block sphere. So if you look at this, this is actually a cone. So we have an object that sort of narrows down to a vertex, so it comes out linearly, and then it ends in this flat surface on top. And likewise, over here we have a cone, and the top of the cone is the Bloch sphere. Since there's four parameters here, it's hard for me to draw this. So I'm just going to draw the top of the cone, where I take z plus pz plus pz minus, these two probabilities equal sum to 1. And then I can draw it. So now I can drop one of these parameters. I can drop the z minus, pz minus parameter. So the thing about the Bloch sphere is normally it's drawn in terms of different parameters. Here I'm using probabilities instead of expectation values. But this is the same object. So now this is the first quadrant octant. This three-dimensional space. I'm going to draw a unit cube inside here. there's a unit cube. And now the state space consists of all the states inside a ball, inside or on ball, that just about fits inside this cube. It's hard to draw a ball fitting inside a cube. And that's the block sphere in different coordinates than the ones normally given in. Incidentally, if you chose coordinates that weren't x, y, and z, if you chose some different axes, then it would turn into an ellipsoid. So if you look at this quantum Zeno effect, you can see the reason it's happening is because evolution is linear in Hilbert space, which means it. So I should say the states that live on the surface of this block sphere are the pure states. And so now, if you have evolution which takes pure states to pure states, which is what unitary evolution does, then it's simply taking you along some line on the block sphere. Okay. And you can see then that the probabilities, whatever probabilities you consider, are going to decay as in a quadratic form, because you know, if you start off here on the top, and you're considering, you know, this is your zero state, the pz plus state, then the initial evolution is along this sphere, which is quadratic in probability space. So this is the reason for the quantum Zeno effect. Over here, on the other hand, if we start off at some point here, then any decay that goes to another point over here is going to be linear in the probability space. And so we'll have something like exponential decay or a decay which is, for small times, it's linear in that small time. So that's the difference between the two cases. Any questions? So all of this discussion was for the case of discrete systems, where you had a countable Hilbert space dimension. So you had this label n labeling the different Hilbert space dimensions. Or here we have just a two-dimensional qubit. What about if we have continuous systems? Well, there's sort of an interesting fact I don't really know what to do with, but it's something that somebody should do something with one day. If you look at, take continuous systems. And consider the classical and the quantum case. So for a classical continuous system, let's imagine this is position, for example. If you want to get from A to B in a continuous fashion with respect to this, well, if you want to get from A to B in a sort of continuous way, then you have to pass through all the points in between. So to go from here to here, in a continuous way, you have to pass incidentally, in the case, in this discrete case here, if I want to get from one point to another, there isn't a continuous option. You have to jump in the classical case. Whereas over here, if you have a continuous, if you have a label which labels your systems continuously like this, then to get from A to B, you have to pass in a continuous way. You can do it by passing continuously through these points. On the other hand, in quantum theory, if you want to get from A to B, imagine this is X as well, in a continuous way, then there actually exists a path which is continuous in the state space, which goes directly from A to B without passing through the points in between. Imagine this is X1, this is X2. Then you can start off in the state X1, then evolve in a continuous way where these parameters alpha and beta start off with alpha equal to 1 and beta equal to 0 and evolve continuously until you end up in the state x2. And at no point in this continuous evolution was there any support in states between A and B. So in some sense, what happens here is you're fading away from position A and fading in position B. This would be real teleportation. It doesn't happen in physics because all the Hamiltonians we write down are local with regard to x. So they require that any evolution actually goes through these points in between. So for physical Hamiltonians, this doesn't happen. But nevertheless, there is this possibility in the state space itself. OK, it's 9:15. I'll stop there. Yep, please.
I don't know. Well, it's a request for a comment. So I always found it kind of weird that when you write down these probability states for quantum theory, they're asymmetric. They
have which
two variables for Z and only one variable
for X. Oh, right, yeah.
And it kind of like, bothers me, and I wonder if you can comment on that.
So you can choose. So you could have chosen X plus and X minus, and then Z plus and Y plus, for example. That would work as well.
Yeah,
you'd have a slightly different relationships, but those relationships, you know, you'd have a different equation. I've lost where it was written. You'd have a different equation here,
sure.
but all the elements of that equation are just conventional. And so.
Yeah, I understand that you can kind of choose which one to prefer, but still it's kind of.
Yeah, it's weird, but I mean, that's the point is that really there's any, you can choose any set of, so if you want to represent a quantum state like this, you calculate these probabilities from the projections, from the projection operators. And you can choose any set of projection operators that are linearly independent. And they will do the job. And then, of course, the relationship between this list of probabilities and the quantum state depends on which set of projectors you choose. It's very similar to, in general relativity, you can choose any coordinate system. Then you just have to take care of that in other places. The same thing is true here. You can choose any set of independent measurements to represent your state. Yeah.
But why do you need the Z minus term?
If you say that your states are always normalized, then you don't need the Z minus. Just like over here, if you say all your states are normalized, then you don't need the last of these ones. But there's a reason, in my mind, not to insist that your states are normalized. And that's if you want to do a linear calculation where you have various measurements in between, well, in quantum theory, after you've made a measurement, the state, you project the state with the projection operator and then it's not normalized. Now, what people normally do is they say, well, let's normalize it again. Okay. It's just like in England, you know, if you ask for a cup of tea, they'll put milk in it, even if you don't want milk. I actually happen to like milk. But the point is, you know, in physics, people, as soon as you give it a state that's not normalized, people want to normalize it. And it's kind of the wrong thing to do because you're throwing away information. The normalization, before you normalize it, there's information in the normalization. It tells you sort of how likely that state is, given how you prepared it. And then if you perform another measurement, then you'll get a new normalization, which will be even smaller. And that normalization tells you how likely that new state is, given the way you prepared it, and so on. And if you don't normalize, then all your calculations can be linear, and you're not throwing away essential information. I'll come to this in the final week. So it's really useful to have that full space available to you, rather than normalizing it. That's why here, I was saying, so this thing here is just the top of the cone. We have the full set of states, if you don't normalize, is consists of ones which have pz plus pz minus, also less than one, all the way down to zero. I think if instead, if I chose a, it's difficult to draw because I haven't got four dimensions. But the full set of states is sort of like this. I'm just drawing part of the block sphere. This is the origin in my system, and it goes all the way up to this. And there's a lot of good reasons to allow this full set of states rather than just the normalized ones. I've been fighting this instinct people have to normalize. Any more questions?